There is, of course, still some refuge for our illusion of self-importance in the idea that we must first make a very resolute effort to bite the bull. Every in-group distinguishes itself from the out-group, the initiates from the hoi polloi, by some process of going through the mill, of enduring sufferings which are subsequently worn as the proud badge of graduation. Thus, one of the more sickening aspects of spiritual phoniness is the usually rather subtly hinted implication that one has, after all, suffered so much. So too, in the person who is still a mere aspirant to the state of grace, the same kind of humbug wears the form of resolutions to bite the bull to the utmost, in order to have oneself finally and effectively convinced that it cannot be done. I have always found that the people who have quite genuinely died to themselves make no claims of any kind to their own part in the process. They think of themselves as lazy and lucky. If they did anything at all, it was so simple that anyone else could do the same. For all that they have done is to recognize a universal fact of life, something as true of the weak and foolish as of the wise and the strong. They would even say that in this respect there is some advantage in being weak and foolish, for the possession of a strong will and a clever head makes some things very difficult to see. A successful merchant will perhaps be less ready than a mere tramp to see that the same oblivion engulfs both of them. To the genuine dead man come alive, sage, mystic, Buddha, Jivanmukta, or what you will, the notion that he attained this state by some effort or by some special capacity of his own is always absurd and impossible. You may almost be sure, then, that some kind of clericalism, some kind of highly refined spiritual racket is at work when stress is laid upon the suffering and the discipline, the endurance and the willpower, which are said to be the essential prerequisites of an entry to the kingdom of heaven. Such talk is sometimes just making the best of a bad job, trying to pretend to oneself that a life of constant self-frustration was in fact a great spiritual attainment. Sometimes it may simply be an honest mistake, for there are people who discover what was always close at hand only after a long and painful journey, and they remain under the impression that the most awkward road was the only road. Sometimes, however, talk of this kind is the really nasty kind of preaching affected by people who presume to be schoolmasters to their fellow man. But their sermons never have the slightest creative effect, since the only motives for action which they supply are shame or fear or guilt. And when we respond to such motives, we find only a balm for the ego's injured pride, a balm upon which our egocentricity flourishes with special gusto. With such misunderstandings out of the way, perhaps we can consider more intimately what it means to find life by losing it. The main point is, I think, that the state metaphorically called death or self-surrender is not a future condition to be acquired. It is, rather, a present fact. In small matters, our ego shows some signs of life. But fundamentally, in the presence of great space and time, as of great love and great fear, we are leaves in the wind. When we begin to think about this clearly, we evoke very disturbing emotions, which we would like to be able to control. Our resistance to these emotions is as natural as the emotions themselves. Indeed, they are really the same as the emotions, since emotions appear only as manifestations of a state of tension and resistance. If I did not dislike fear, it would not be fear. Nevertheless, there is, I think, no difficulty in discovering that our resentment of those emotions, our unwillingness to experience them, is totally ineffectual. It is the mosquito biting the iron bull again. The fragility and frailty of our human bodies within the merciless and marvelous torrent of life evokes every emotion of this agonizingly sensitive organism. Love, anger, sadness, terror, and the fear of terror. And our attempts to stand above these emotions and control them are emotions themselves at play, since love is also to be in love with love, and sadness to be sorry that one is sad. Our unwillingness to feel is the very measure of our ability to feel, for the more sensitive the instrument, the greater its capacity for pain, and so for reluctance to be hurt. Now, there are some psychologists who have struck, rather clumsily perhaps, upon an important truth, namely, that there is a serious mistake in not responding to our feelings, or in trying to feel in some other way than we feel actually. They are speaking here, it should be noted, of inward feelings and not of overt action. In other words, if you, as a mother, hate your child, don't try to pretend to yourself that you love him. But, put in this rather oversimplified way, this insight degenerates into another precept. Accept your feelings. Go along with your emotions. It is not that simple, because our feelings conflict with one another, as, for example, when you are too proud to cry or too frightened to fall in love. In this case, which feeling do we accept? The sorrow or the pride? The fear or the love? Now, this is a most instructive example of the difficulty of self-acceptance. For in such a situation, we find that we can accept neither. The conflict will not allow itself to be resolved by a decision for one of the two sides. And we are stuck helplessly with the conflict. But the real importance of what these psychologists are trying to say is that there is an almost uncanny wisdom in the spontaneous and natural reactions of our organism to the course of events. The extraordinary capacity to feel an event inwardly, as distinct from bursting into precipitate action to avoid the tension of feeling. This capacity is, in fact, a wonderful power of adaptation to life, not unlike the instant responses of flowing water to the contours of the ground over which it flows. I hope this is clear. I am not talking at the moment of responses in terms of action, but only of our inward subjective responses of feeling. The point is that our feelings are not really a kind of resistance, a kind of fight with the course of events. They are a harmonious and intelligent response. A person who did not feel frightened at the threat of danger would be like a tall building with no give to the wind. A mind which will not melt with sorrow or love is a mind which will all too easily break. Now, the reason why I'm talking of feeling rather than outward action is that I am considering the predicament of man in the face of events about which nothing can be done. Events towards which our sole response is a response of feeling. I am thinking of the ultimate certainty of death, the overall helplessness of man within the vast tide of life, and, finally, of the very special feelings which arise when we are faced with conflict of feelings which cannot be resolved. All these situations evoke feelings which, in the long run, are as irresistible as these situations themselves are insoluble. They are the ultimate feelings, and much of what is called philosophy is the fruitless attempt to talk oneself out of them. Thus, what I have called the death of the ego transpires in the moment when it is discovered and admitted that these ultimate feelings are irresistible. They are ultimate in two senses. One, that they sometimes have to do with very fundamental and cataclysmic events, and two, that they are sometimes our deepest, most radical feelings with respect to a given situation, such as the basic frustration provoked by a conflict between sorrow and shame. The point is that these ultimate feelings are as wise as all the rest, and their wisdom emerges when we give up resisting them, through the realization that we are simply unable to do so. When, for example, life compels us at last to give in, to surrender to the full play of what is ordinarily called the terror of the unknown, the suppressed feeling suddenly shoots upward as a fountain of the purest joy. What was formerly felt as the horror of our inevitable mortality becomes transformed by an inner alchemy into an almost ecstatic sense of freedom from the bonds of individuality. But ordinarily, we do not discover the wisdom of our feelings because we do not let them complete their work. We try to suppress them or discharge them in premature action, not realizing that they are a process of creation which, like birth, begins as pain and turns into a child. I hope it is possible to say all this without tying it up with the atmosphere of oughtness, without giving anyone the notion that this kind of self-surrender is something which one should or can do. This willful, compulsive, moralistic approach to man's transformation always obstructs it. For it still implies that very illusion of self-mastery which stands in the way. But it is just when I discover that I cannot surrender myself that I am surrendered. Just when I find that I cannot accept myself that I am accepted. For in reaching this hard rock of the impossible, one reaches sincerity, where there can no longer be the masked hide-and-seek of I and me. Good I trying to change bad me, who is really the same fellow as good I. In the expressive imagery of Zen, all this striving for self-surrender is like trying to put legs on a snake. Or, shall I say, like a naked man trying to lose his shirt. To quote from that genial Taoist Chuang Tzu, from the standpoint of the sage, the joined is not united, nor the separated apart, nor the long in excess, nor the short wanting. For just as a duck's legs, though short, cannot be lengthened without pain to the duck, and a crane's legs, though long, cannot be shortened without misery to the crane, so that which is long in man's moral nature cannot be cut off, nor that which is short be lengthened. Become what you are. It has been said that the highest wisdom lies in detachment, or, in the words of Chuang Tzu, the perfect man employs his mind as a mirror. It grasps nothing, it refuses nothing, it receives but does not keep. Detachment means to have neither regrets for the past nor fears for the future, to let life take its course without attempting to interfere with its movement and change, neither trying to prolong the stay of things pleasant nor to hasten the departure of things unpleasant. To do this is to move in time with life, to be in perfect accord with its changing music. And this is called enlightenment. In short, it is to be detached from both past and future and to live in the eternal now. For in truth, neither past nor future have any existence apart from this now. By themselves, they are illusions. Life exists only at this very moment. And in this moment, it is infinite and eternal. For the present moment is infinitely small. Before we can measure it, it has gone. And yet it persists forever. This movement and change has been called Dao by the Chinese, yet in fact there is no movement. For the moment is the only reality, and there is nothing beside it in relation to which it can be said to move. Thus, it can be called at once the eternally moving and the eternally resting. How can we bring ourselves into accord with this Tao? A sage has said that if we try to accord with it, we shall get away from it. But he was not altogether right. For the curious thing is that you cannot get out of accord with it even if you want to. Though your thoughts may run into the past or the future, they cannot escape the present moment. However far back or forward they try to escape, they can never be separated from the moment. For those thoughts are themselves of the moment, just as much as anything else they partake of, and indeed are the movement of life, which is Tao. You may believe yourself out of harmony with life and its eternal now, but you cannot be, for you are life and exist now. Otherwise, you would not be here. Hence, the infinite Tao is something which you can neither escape by flight nor catch by pursuit. There is no coming toward it or going away from it. It is, and you are it. So, become what you are. The Finger and the Moon. There is an old Christian phrase, Crux Medicina Mundi, the cross, the medicine of the world, a phrase which is rather remarkable in that it suggests that religion is a medicine rather than a diet. The difference is, of course, that medicine is something to be taken occasionally, like penicillin, whereas a diet is regular food. Perhaps this analogy cannot be pressed too far, since there are medicines like insulin which some people have to take all the time. But there is a point to the analogy, a point expressed in another Latin saying, not at all Christian, since its author was Lucretius. Tatum religio potuit suade malorum. Too much religion is apt to encourage evil. I am not thinking so much of the exploitation of the poor by a corrupt priesthood, or of the obvious evils of zealotry and fanaticism,